Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Monster Baby Podcast, a curious romp through the worlds of mindfulness and improvisation. My name is Ted Desmaisons.
I am Lisa Rowland, and we are your hosts for this curious romp. This episode is our third episode in our adventure of this podcast, and it talks about community, whether mindfulness and improvisation breed community in the same way, in different ways, how the interactivity of improv strikes a balance or a contrast to the more solitary, how mindfulness can be practiced in a more solitary way, and how those might affect the communities that those two disciplines build.
Yeah, we talked about how they kind of balance each other out, and then also the need for a general balance in our lives with times of activity and stimulation and times of quiet and integration.
Yeah, the conversation kind of rambles. It kind of roams about. So hopefully you'll enjoy it and get something out of it.
A little bit of a romp. And I think you may find intriguing towards the end. We start talking about how community provides belonging and what is a tribe and why we long for tribes. And then we also spend a little bit of time talking about presence and the ways that just being present for each other in that kind of community, it can actually be healing in and of itself. Yeah. So we hope you enjoy.
Yeah, one thing that you may notice is we are in our baby podcast state. We are figuring out the technical needs of such a thing. And so for this podcast, for this recording, we had a couple of technical difficulties, and you may notice some unevenness in the sound between Ted's voice and mine. But everything is still clear and audible. It's just a little bit uneven at times. So yeah. If you notice that, that's why. But we think we're on the way to correcting it.
Yeah, so we hope you can forgive us. We beg, we plead for your forgiveness. But trust that the content will provide you with some little boost, some interesting interesting reference for you. And we're so psyched that you're with us. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you on the backside.
Yep. All bye-bye.
Right. Ciao. Let's talk about community. We just came off a great weekend where the Stanford improvisers gathered together all 25 years. Well, not everybody, but almost half of the Stanford improvisers over the 25-year history of the group got together on campus, and we spent the weekend playing with each other, sharing stories, finding out what each other is up to, laughing, singing.
Yeah, meeting new improvisers, reconnecting with old improvisers. It was tremendous. It was a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And so what we were talking about in wanting to, we knew we wanted to schedule a podcast, a recording for right after this retreat, and we were, or rather at the reunion, and we were thinking about what to talk about. And the thing that really rose to the top for me is the way this practice of improvisation creates community, and my wondering if mindfulness is the same way, mm-hmm. I suppose. And because the overwhelming feeling for me was, my God, I've never felt as a part of a tribe as I do with improvisers, and specifically with SIMPs, which is Stanford Improvisers.
Yes. Yeah, I'm wondering what is that tribe feeling as a starting point? Like, what? Describe that. What does that mean to you?
It feels like, to be cliche about it, it feels like home. It feels very safe.
Kind of a belonging.
And belonging.
Yep.
And like, I don't have to explain myself here.
Nice.
I don't have to prove anything to anyone. I totally belong here. We speak the same language. We get something on a level that is, we get important things in the same way. We understand important things in the same way.
Yeah.
Which makes it very easy to connect, even if we haven't seen one another for years, which was true of a lot of the people that I saw there. It was like, you know, I wouldn't say we picked up where we left off. It was easy to connect. It was so easy to connect in a way that is not the same in a lot of groups.
I had that feeling. You know, we had this reunion 5 years ago where you and I met, and there were people at this reunion I hadn't seen since then, but I definitely picked up right away.
Yeah.
For me, there's a sense of when I feel at home or feel at belonging in community, it's partly that I get to bring all of myself to the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't have to, is there anything that I want to do, or is like, this is fair, fair to bring into it, and it's going to be welcomed and received.
And
I also have this feeling, distinctly so, with a group of people who attend the Applied Improvisation Network annual conference, group of folks who are using improv principles and practices in other arenas, healthcare, education, business, personal growth.
Right. Is that you show up and you, there, it's almost as though there's a certain amount of shit of assumed commonality or assumed like-mindedness. We just already know that we're all in this for similar reasons, or we're all into this, into similar things, and therefore we can skip a lot of the ramp up time of figuring out what you're about.
Right.
We know at least some of the stuff that you're about.
Yeah, there's a familiarity. Somebody used the term this weekend, there's a common language.
Mm-hmm.
I just had the thought, like, oh, so this is a cult? You know, it's like, maybe that's a conversation we get to a little bit later. Like, what's the difference between community and cult? But, oh, now we're talking. Welcome to the improv community.
Well, I think that probably, especially people who are connected to people, I think people who are connected to improvisers may very well describe it as a cult.
Yeah. Well, there can be an obsessiveness of like, I'm or an addiction to it. Like, so thrilling.
There's a book written about theater sports called Something Like a Drug, which is an oral history of theater sports. And it is something like a drug. It's addictive. So there's that part. There's a common language. There's certain words we use together. There's certain common vocabulary that we tap into. Anyway, I don't think it's a cult, but
yeah,
I think it's a very, very strong community.
I think another thing that builds community for me is shared experience, shared intention.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, the intention is to create improvised theater. Play creates community. And I also think that a lot of the games that we play are on an energetic level creating a kind of community.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we stand in a circle, and let's say we're playing sound ball. We send a sound. I make a sound, and you receive it by repeating that sound across the circle, and then you send another sound to somebody else, and they receive it. It's like we're stitching a web across the circle, almost literally, right?
Yeah.
And so you're building this flexible, sturdy tapestry, energetic tapestry together.
Yeah.
And then you're now bound together.
Interesting.
You know, you go forward.
Yeah.
So like,
I mean, it feels like I think that's, there's something about the specific, like there's the circle games that all of us are involved in, which are bonding in and of themselves, but there are also the skills of improvisation, which are community building skills of listening and taking care of each other. And these are skills that we practice, are listening and making you write and going on adventures together and being vulnerable together and trust and sharing control and using your input and all of those things that support connection.
Yeah.
And so maybe this is something that I wonder about your experience in the mindfulness community is that the same? Because we were talking about this a little bit before. I think that if you do anything with a group of people, it will build community. If any endeavor, so a sports team.
Yeah, I want to dive into that a little bit. Keep going. Yeah. I want to come back to that.
So, or you're in a class together, or you're doing a retreat together, or, you know, shared experience builds community. And working on something together builds community. But the specific things we are working on as improvisers are skills that are about how we treat one another. They're accelerators. That's not always true in other pursuits.
Yeah.
So my assumption would be that a lot of that applies in a mindfulness community because those are all about, you know, those skills are about acceptance and attention, awareness, generosity, curiosity and kindness and non-judgmentalness. So I think there's a lot of overlap, but I wonder if there is quite the same thing because so many of the improv skills are by definition interactive. And a lot of the mindfulness practice is not.
Yeah.
It can be applied to interactions, but it's not at its core interactive.
Okay, so I want to go back a touch because you were saying that any shared activity builds community.
Yeah.
I think any shared activity builds a bond of some sort, but I don't think it necessarily builds community, because I think it's the way that one goes about whatever the shared activity is mm-hmm. that creates that or not. Right. So it could create animosity, the shared activity.
Yeah.
It does create a bond. Yeah. But you know, if you're going at it, if it's hostile or people are nasty to each other or there's competition for resources, right, you can build up this kind of toxicity. And I'm not sure that's building community. But because improv, as you mentioned, is about generosity and shared discovery, there's a delight in it, but like we're creating something together.
Yeah.
And that's, well, yeah, that's community. Like, I'm thinking calm, unity, like you're with and you're one. This is separate and one. We're doing something together that's creating something that's us together. Mm-hmm. So I do think that the skills are particularly productive or lead to an emerging community.
Yeah, they're really connective skills. They, as improvisers, we learn how to connect better. That's what we're working on. We learn how to collaborate better, how to notice each other better.
Collaborate, shared control.
Yeah. Right?
So, yeah, it's the, we get to the end result and we look at it and we say, you know what? I didn't control this. I couldn't have done this by myself. Mm-hmm. And yet I can see myself in the end result. I'm visible in that final product. We look back on that scene we did and like, yep, I was there. Mm-hmm. And yet I couldn't have done it by myself.
Yeah. And sometimes in the best scenes, you don't even know what you did.
That's right.
You can't even pick out your contribution.
Right.
Yeah. Which are my favorites, actually.
Love them.
I wasn't responsible for a thing in that scene. Yeah. But everybody else feels that too.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and anybody looking at it from the outside would say, well, of course you were.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I do think that mindfulness does that. Although, you know, of course, I don't think of doing improv solo. Whereas one can practice mindfulness solo.
Yeah.
So if I meditate in the morning by myself or I do yoga or I'm going for a walk or I'm doing the dishes.
Right.
Or...
Well, when there's a gathering, what is the tone? Like, how do you, because so at an improv festival that I was at in Würzburg, Germany, I described it at the time, like going to a family reunion full of people I had not met yet. So it's like a lot of people that I had never met, but I immediately felt like family with them in a way.
Yeah.
And it's even stronger with the Simps, obviously, because we actually have shared experience as well as a common language and a shared goal. But it really felt like, oh, you are my people. And I wonder if you have a similar feeling when you go to mindfulness, gatherings, retreats, events.
Yeah, so there's two things. Let's talk about secular mindfulness and then mindfulness in a religious or, in this case, Buddhist setting. Yeah. So I've been on silent retreats, secular silent retreats. Well, I guess they were Buddhist retreats, but they were silent. So there is this really intense sense of community. I did a 3-day silent retreat, a 5-day, a 7-day. There's an intense kind of community that develops, even though you're not talking to anybody. You're silent. You're not reading. You're not writing. You're not using a computer. You're not using your telephone. And there's also something called noble silence, which is you're not even making eye contact, as a way of really tuning in to what's going on for you. And that when we're making eye contact, even if we're not saying anything out loud, we're saying 8 zillion things through our exquisite genetic evolution to be able to understand facial, you know, micro gestures, right? And if I make eye contact with you, I'm suddenly pulled into that relationship. Whereas if we're not making eye contact, I'm staying inside, noticing my own experience. Okay, and then you go into the meditation hall. You're sitting next to people in silence, shared silence, powerful. Maybe there's a question somebody asks of the teacher and the teacher answers, and that's the extent of any speaking. You get to the end of the retreat, though, and you feel like, oh, these are my people. I haven't said a word to them, and yet I feel bonded to them.
Mm-hmm.
We've committed to something together. We have put an effort into creating a container that has served us all.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that shared outcome is the wrong word, but
experience.
Emergence, yeah, experience.
Right? I mean, you're sharing an experience.
We created something together in service to each other. So there's a generosity in that.
Yeah.
I'm not just keeping silence for myself. I'm not just keeping my eye contact to myself for my own purposes. I'm doing it to serve you as well.
Well, it's to serve this experience that we're all after.
That's right.
So in that way, it's like creating a scene.
Yep.
This other thing is created by all of our efforts, and then we serve that thing.
Right.
Right, so it's not like I'm avoiding eye contact for you. It's like, because that is what this experience is demanding.
Yeah.
Which is, there's a thin line,
right,
again. But.
Right, and so I think that in that silent retreat setting, there's a commitment to ethics. You know, you're sort of treating each other well, and there's a commitment to that curiosity and kindness for your own experience, and that sort of, like we were talking about with those web exercises, fills the room, right? Literally, we're conspiring together. We're breathing together,
mm-hmm,
in this intention. And like the walls hold that and then echo it back out. And there have been people in this space before who have done the same thing. And we're feeding on that and giving back to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's parallel in that way. I think that gets even more amplified in a religious community where people are talking and sharing stories and laughing together or crying together, like you get the wider range of the human experience as well as that silent practice.
Are there ever mindfulness events where you get to talk to each other?
Sure. You might go to a mindfulness talk, or you might go to, you know, like I've been on mindfulness programs where we're talking about how to teach mindfulness.
Yeah.
And so we're doing exercises and then having a period of silence and then coming back out of that. One of the retreats I went on was an insight dialogue retreat. And so we were learning how to speak mindfully with each other. It was not a conversation. It wasn't a dialogue. I wasn't going to be like asking you questions. I was helping you pay attention to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much slower. And there's a lot more pause built in to like, let me check in with my body right now. Okay, so there's a little, you know, a little warmth radiating in my chest. And so I might notice that and say that out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Or I might just give voice, oh, there's a little bit of, feels like a little tension in the back of my throat.
Yeah.
I have a question, which is slightly off topic.
Okay.
A little bit. But I think it's interesting, which is I have experienced in the study of improvisation that I think is a combination of my personality that is kind of people-pleasy. A little bit.
Okay.
That I am very much wanting to show my partner a good time. Focusing on you, supporting your calls,
yes,
helping you go where you want to go. And that was actually a journey I really had to take in improv and in life to figure out what I wanted and what my calls were and be willing to make strong calls and not just support other people's calls.
Yeah.
I know not every improviser fights that same battle, but if we're really, I think sometimes we can go too far in the taking care of your partner and we forget to bring anything on ourselves.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the same is true in mindfulness where you're so inwardly focused that can you cross the line and it becomes too insular or I guess self-centered is the kind of negative connotation of that.
Yeah.
Of you're just like so about your own experience that it's like, okay, well, what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
You know, like you got to put that out in the world somehow. And do people go too far in that direction
yes.
Navel gazing?
Some do, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that the best teachers are those who are teaching a kind of 50-50, you know, and that most of us are completely inexperienced at checking in internally.
Yeah.
We're totally unaware of our bodies, totally unaware of our thought patterns, totally unaware of how our emotions get pulled and how our likes and dislikes are triggering everything we do.
Uh-huh.
And so we have to take time to get to know that and build those muscles,
learn how to do that.
Yeah. And in order to do that, you really have to let go of all of the magnets that other people put on us.
Mm-hmm.
We try to please them or serve them in some way. I think that the best mindfulness teachers are those who combine them. And I'm thinking of Jessica Morey, who's the executive director of the Inward Bound Mindfulness Education Group, who runs retreats for teenagers. I love the retreats that they do. I've volunteered for a couple of them. because a lot of it is in silence, going inward, checking in with yourself, and a lot of it is in small group conversation about things that really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then we might have a dance on the last night, or we might play music together, or we might have a shared ritual, or we might have a workshop about addiction, or we might have a workshop about sexuality awareness, or we might have a workshop about how to deal with difficult families.
Yeah, so it's exploring the both in combination.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you're kind of going back and forth. And again, to me, this is like a breathing thing, right? So my ideal is to be on a retreat where you're kind of doing both. And I think that's a lot of what we've tried to develop with our Mindful Play, Playful Mind retreat, is to say, okay, we're going to be goofy and silly and creative and noisy.
And interactive, and plugged in and energetic. And
Yeah. And then we'll start each day with some quiet time, shared quiet time together.
Yeah.
And we'll take some quiet time during each thing. I mean, part of it's like the introvert in me, like, oh, great, I get a chance to integrate this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just introverts. I think most people could use a chance to integrate. What have we just done? Okay, let's take some quiet time and do that. Okay, now let's come back out.
Right, and some people do that in quiet time, and some people don't do it in quiet time.
Right.
Like, you and I think, are so different in this way, because you, when you need to think about something and puzzle it out, you sit down with your journal.
Yeah.
And I call my mom. Like, I have to call somebody, and like, sometimes I don't even know that something's on my mind until I notice that I start talking about it.
Right.
Like, I find it out once it's outside of my head a lot of times.
When we've done our workshops, though, I seem to remember that, you know, when we have participated, that you have really valued, you know, a little bit of reflection time or time to read.
I do. But a lot of the way that I figure stuff out
normally
is out loud.
Okay.
It's like very externally processed.
Yes, yes.
So it's not 100%.
Right.
But it's not a given that, quiet time will help people figure out what they got out
right.
of that.
Right, right.
You know, and I love having a break from the energy. So for me, what the quiet time does is it allows me to, it just gives my brain a rest from paying attention to other people.
Right.
And what they... How I can plug in with them.
Right. And we talked about that a bunch this weekend, because here we were with 140 awesome people who we totally love, and great stuff was happening, and more
all
great stuff
time.
Was happening, and here was another great show, and oh my God, and now we're having lunch, and there's 40, and I was like, can I just go for a walk around the lake for a little bit?
Yeah.
Let the rain fall on my head.
It was packed.
Packed
with awesome, and awesome can be fatiguing.
Yeah, but so I love that. I love that kind of breathing quality of like, let's work with other people and go internal.
Mm-hmm.
Work with other people and go internal, and I sometimes wonder if it's better to do them separately. So like, no, go be on a silent retreat. Do the silence for 3 days, 5 days, 7 days. Sink into it. Really have that experience. Or go do an improv intensive.
Mm-hmm.
Really do it. I wonder, but I think my preference is to
have both.
Have it be an in and out.
Like, this is the concept behind yin yang, right? It's like there's a little bit of this in that, there's a little bit of this other thing. There's
right. The seed of one is in the heart of the other.
In the heart of the other. And there's that balance is really nice.
Yeah.
I feel like, go do a silent retreat. Yes, go do a silent retreat. And yes, go do an improv retreat. And yes, go do big, wild, loud adventures. And yes, go do quiet, inward, introspective adventures. And life is made of all of those things. So if you can't integrate them, if you can't figure out a way to find outrageous joy and quiet in your day or in your life, then it's not as valuable.
Right.
I think ultimately the value is being able to find one and the other in your life.
Yeah.
So that it can actually make a difference on the ground instead of in the held space of the retreat.
Right.
In whichever discipline you're doing.
Yeah. And there are different levels we could look for this kind of balance. So it's like, okay, do I need yin-yang balance within this hour?
Yeah.
Okay, as a teacher, when I was teaching high school, I thought about that, like, Okay, I'm going to have a little transition time here between this exercise and the next exercise. Like, you know, or we need to get up and move, or we need to sit and be quiet for a little bit because we've just been really noisy. So within the space of an hour, or is it within the space of the day? Like, okay, I want to make sure to have some internal time when I wake up, and then I'm out in the world, and I come home and take a nap, and then I go back out at night. Or is it within the space of a week, or a month, or a year, or a lifetime? You know.
Right.
So maybe there are the different periods of our lives. Like, oh, Lisa's in her quiet phase now.
Yeah, right.
And now she's really crazy.
Yeah.
So I think that in a religious community, you know, this all this stuff gets amplified because you're having a wider range of experience. And I was thinking about Quakers too. I don't know what it is. There's something about shared silence that's very different than solo silence.
Uh-huh. You
know, you and I sit in a room and we are willing to be quiet together. It's like nothing's needed except each other.
Interesting.
I love it. Yeah. Love it. And I noticed that on Saturday morning during this reunion this weekend, there were a few of us who got together in the contemplative space on campus. And it was just a small group, and nobody was talking to each other. I just walked in there. I walked in late, but I walked in and was, oh, great. Oh, I just want to sit in this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's Kevin over there. There's Monica over there. There's Lisa in there. It's just like, I love this.
Yeah.
And then we go to the next thing.
Yeah.
Totally cool.
Yeah.
I mentioned the Applied Improv Network. We've talked about this reunion of our Stanford Improvisers group. Do you feel this way with any improvisers?
Well,
Bats, your Bats Improv colleagues, do you feel that way?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's not as strong as with the Stanford Improvisers.
Okay.
And there also is something about that retreat setting, right? So this festival that I went to was like, we're all going away to this one place to engage in this weekend or 4 days full of improvisation.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you go there and that's what you're there for. And there's something about the intentionality of that time that it is already a community in the format in which it's happening.
Right.
So with Bats, it's different because it's all life. It's we like get together on every other Monday and we have shows on the weekends and we, you know, so it's not as concentrated community, but I definitely feel like they're my family.
Well, and you all don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it 22 of
22,
you?
22, yeah.
22 of you don't really get together to hang out much.
No.
Like you perform together and so you've got this exquisitely refined process and pattern of being generous and kind and curious and playful with each other on stage, but you don't get to do that kind of playful banter on the side. I mean, the handful of the folks are your good friends, but some you don't hang out with.
Some I don't hang out with as much, and some I do hang out with more. And, you know, in any big group, that will happen. But I think were I to hang out with any of them, I would have that dynamic with
yes.
them. Simps are, it was my social world.
Yes.
My best friends still are
hailed from.
The people that I'm still best friends with were simps. Are simps. So it is a really different thing. And at Bats, we love each other and it feels kind of like a family. And there's times when you don't like your family very much.
Uh-huh.
That you love them and you know you're in this together, but you're not always going to get along.
Right.
And so it has a different feeling, but I still feel like they are my family. Like
yeah.
I can be open and honest, and I respect them so much.
Well, this has been an interesting conversation that we have had. But you and I are both board members of Bats Improv.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been an interesting conversation we've had about what is the Bats community.
Yeah.
Because it originally started as really the theater.
The performing company. Not even a theater.
Right. Right on.
A group of people.
A group of people who perform together. And now there's a school of improv, and now there's a group that takes improv out to businesses and school settings and educational settings.
Yeah.
And then there's a group of people, the students who are taking the classes and the people who come to the shows regularly, some of them religiously.
Yeah.
And so what is the community? And from my perspective, someone who moved to San Francisco almost a couple of years ago now, part of my draw was like this improv community and specifically the Bats improv community for me. There's a wider improv community in San Francisco, too. but this feeling of belonging. And yeah. I go up to that third floor of Fort Mason Building B, and I come off the elevator or come up the stairs, and I turn the corner. It's like, I love this space.
Here.
I belong here.
I'm welcome here. I know how things work here.
Yeah.
I'm a part of it.
I contribute. It serves me.
Yeah. Yeah. The other place I have that is at Girl Scout camp. I feel totally at home at Girl Scout camp, which is a camp that I've gone to. It's called Two Sentinels Girl Scout Camp on Lake Kirkwood in the Sierras. I've been going since I was 9, which was a very long time ago.
Not that long ago.
It's quite a while.
Some of our listeners may be old enough to think that that was not very long ago.
Okay, 24 years seems like a long time.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
It's long for me. It's most of my life.
Sure.
I've been going to Girl Scout camp, and now I work there. You know, I started volunteering as staff there when I was 17. And so at that place, I feel like I get this place, and this place gets me. It's part of who I am. I am part of what it is.
Okay, so you've just identified two communities, Girl Scouts and, three, maybe Bats and Semps. All three of these are ones that you have been part of for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any communities that you have felt a part of where it was, like, instantaneous or it happened really quickly?
Well, like I mentioned, going to this improv festival, they were improvisers, okay. But I had never met some of them before.
Okay.
Many of them before.
Yeah.
And it feels like we just fell into having a good time together right away.
Yeah.
Without any shared experience with them, except that we've all been improvising for a long time.
Right. There was, you know, since I was a little kid, I've been a total list maker. Like, let me brainstorm all the different ways. This is true. I think I've told you that I used to, like, rank my friends and family like a top 40, and I'd do a new one each week when I was a kid.
You would re-rank them and see who moved up or down the list.
Yeah, and my cat that I got for my 11th birthday dominated the list. until I met Sarah Tuttle, my first girlfriend in sixth grade, and
she took number one.
They duked it out
neck and neck
for that number one spot
for your favor.
But so I'm
got like, a little extra from Sarah Tuttle, maybe that might have influenced her spot on the list.
we did swim at the Y MCA together.
Enough
so
said.
Yeah,
is that what they're calling it?
But so I'm like a list maker. I love doing that. And a while back, I made a list of all the different tribes that I'm a part of.
Mm.
And it was fascinating because I came up with like 40 tribes. I'm like, so who do I belong to? And the one that showed up the most was Stanford somehow, like the Simps and Talisman, the acapella group I sang in. And or if I go to a reunion, I could feel like, we're going to have something that I can connect on. But there was also the group of people who have been on this music cruise that my dad and my stepmom have taken me on a few times, and it's this really tight group of people, or people who are fans of Brandi Carlile's music, or people who have went to work at Chewonky Summer Camp on the coast of Maine.
Yeah.
Like, anybody I meet from Chewonky, there's something, I don't even know them, and yet we feel this connection. There's a Chewonky community that is palpable.
Right, it's like Simps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, maybe it's, it's like, I think it's a tribal longing. Like, we want to belong. This is inbred. Maybe it's the wrong word.
We're social creatures, right?
Yeah.
It's like, if there's an in and out, we want to be in. We're not loners. We want to belong places. Our survival depended on it. And I think that is...
It's powerful.
It's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful.
And so, sort of looping back around, we're suggesting that improv and mindfulness are two things that, done well, taught in the right spirit or offered in the right spirit, generate this kind of belonging. Right? Would you agree with that? Are we saying that?
Yes. I think that was the question is, do they do that in the same way? Because I think one of the big differences is that the things we're very actively and specifically cultivating in improv are interactive, caring,
mm-hmm.
collaborative skills specifically, whereas in mindfulness it's not that specifically. All the skills that we cultivate in a mindfulness practice applied to collaboration will make for better collaboration.
Yeah, so maybe the answer is yes, they're similar if you take the step of not just being navel gazing, but saying, I'm going to apply this in my world with other people.
Yeah.
So
I'm
going to be curious and kind with my spouse's or my child's or my parents' response. I mean, when they do something that triggers me, I'm like, okay, put this into practice. I'm going to give them space. I'm going to be generous.
Yeah.
I would imagine they do. I think that mindfulness, you know, there's a lot of debate in the mindfulness community about, like, can you teach it outside of the, can you take it away from Buddhism, or can you take it away from any other religious tradition and just teach it by itself without teaching compassion or kindness explicitly?
Yeah.
Right? If you want to develop compassion, you'll get that by teaching compassion more so than by teaching mindfulness. And if you teach mindfulness, you'll get compassion too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there was a really interesting study at Stanford. Jeannie Tsai, who's in the psych department, was wanting to, and I don't know the specifics, so I'm going to have to sort of speak generally here, but was wanting to see, does mindfulness training develop compassion?
Mm-hmm.
And she found that, yes, it did. And so there were two control groups. One of the control groups was a group that had a nutrition class, I think, and no change in their compassion rating. Another group took an improv class with Dan Klein.
Oh my gosh.
And their compassion scores rose similarly to the mindfulness group.
In similar proportion?
In similar proportion. Interesting, right?
Yeah.
And so then there's the question, okay, is that improv? Or is that improv being taught by Dan Klein? Because in the Stanford Improvisers, you know, we are again drawing on that legacy of Patricia Ryan Madsen and her way of doing improv.
Yeah, that incorporates...
specifically is pointing towards generosity. It's not about you.
Well, it's also, she teaches it as a set of values.
Yes.
Like, she teaches it so that as a kind of morality.
Right.
Which is not the same in all improv communities.
Correct.
Or by all improv teachers.
Yeah.
And is not necessary. But that's what I think makes the sense so strongly connected, is that she doesn't pretend that this is not about the way we approach one another in general, as teammates and castmates.
And people living in the same world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's all there, right? But where Professor Tsai was going with her research is to say, okay, well, now that's interesting. What if we teach compassion? How does that compare?
Mm.
I don't know that she's done that research yet, or.
But that's the open question.
For me, the open question was that I was just intrigued by. I'm not a researcher, but I was like, wouldn't this be interesting? What happens if you teach them both?
Mindfulness
and improv.
Oh.
Right? Yeah, and then you could say, what if you teach all three?
Right.
But if you are teaching mindfulness, or if you're teaching mindful improv, like we're trying to do, does it even get higher? Does it get juiced even more?
Right.
Because you're giving people, as we were talking earlier, the quiet mode, the playful mode.
Yeah, you're cross-referencing. It's like bringing people to it from different angles and in different contexts and activities and modes.
All of the brain, all of the body,
all of the heart.
All of the heart, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's intriguing to me. Like, when you put these together, it's not just that they're doing similar things. I think there's an alchemy that creates something greater than each of them alone.
Yeah.
But coming back to this notion of, you know, a lot of people are concerned about taking mindfulness out of their larger frame.
Uh-huh.
I still think, even if it's outside of the other frame, even if you're not attaching compassion to it, even if you're not emphasizing kindness, you're even just focusing on that bare attention, there's something about it that develops the compassion naturally. Like, if you're really paying, you're reserving judgment and you're noticing what's true, you'll start to notice that everything is interconnected. And when you start to notice that everything's interconnected, you start to realize, oh, wait, you are not separate from me. I'm not separate from this animal or this plant or this thing.
You think that's a mindfulness? That's not a religious belief? That's not a religiously fueled belief?
Well, I think it's definitely religiously supported. But I think that the practice of mindfulness, of coming to see things clearly, and this is how Buddhism developed, when you look closely, if you sustain your attention, you start to learn things change.
Yeah.
That's part of the nature of existence.
Right.
Right? And you start to see, like, okay, everything's a part of anything else.
Well, how do you start to see that?
Okay, so...
Well, that feels like a belief.
So, great.
That's not as observable.
This is one that Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Zen monk, who's one of the greatest teachers of mindfulness in the Western world, talks about a lot. He says, you know, if you take a piece of paper is made up of all these non-paper elements.
Yeah.
So what goes into creating... Have we talked about this before?
No.
What goes into taking it... What goes into making a piece of paper? I'll ask you.
Wood. Crushed up and water to process it. And
great.
Machinery to lay it flat and it becomes... And you dry it.
Okay, great. What goes into the wood?
Sunlight and nutrients from the soil.
Great. And...
So we're all bacteria. Made from the same stuff.
So it's all...
Is that what you're saying?
Well, and if you take any of those nodes of things, the non-paper elements that go into the paper,
yeah.
And you... So, okay, what are the elements that made up that thing?
Okay, so just physically, I mean, like, literally, we're all made of the same stuff.
Not,
everything is made of the same
not
stuff.
Just made of it, it's, like, interconnected.
Uh-huh.
Right? So that piece of paper, it's being here on my table, on my desk. There are people involved in that paper arriving on my desk.
Yeah, okay.
Right? And if I'm actually paying attention to what's there, all of those people, all of those elements are present in my moment, in my space.
Whether you notice them or not.
Whether you notice them or not.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that... So the Buddha, the name Buddha means the awakened one, the one who woke up. Well, it's like, that's what being awake means, is to be able to see that all the time. And I have this kind of image of a shimmering reality. If you put those glasses on, like the Buddha glasses, you're like, whoa, I could see the flashing light in a way that everything is connected, and I have to take them off and be like, okay, I'm just going to live in my regular world for a bit because it's too blinding.
Yeah.
But I think that mindfulness leads you to that. I think that paying attention to your breath, it's sort of like the same way that paying attention to your breath without having to change it almost always calms you down.
Uh-huh.
Not always, but usually it just happens.
Yeah.
Because this is the way life works. And so it's like yoga. Do you have to do yoga as a religious practice in order to have its value, in order for it to start to change your life and make you more equanimous? No. If you do it, you put yourself in that position, you align your breath with your movement, it's going to start to trigger a cascade that's going to...
Could you practice yoga without it becoming... without it having that effect?
Yeah, because I think the manner in which you practice the yoga could make a difference. So if you're doing it like competitive or, you know,
or like just for the fitness, just for your body, just to get your...
I still think that even then, you know, if I'm struggling in my yoga to, like, if I'm tense about it, then maybe I'm not going to get the benefit. But if I'm really allowing it to be, if I'm allowing myself to be present, it heals. Presence heals, maybe, is same thing when we're with other people.
Yeah.
You just got to be there with the person. That's the most precious thing we have nowadays, is our ability to actually just hang out with someone.
Yeah. And I think actually the best scenes are when two people look comfortable just being on stage together, two or three or four or however many. And so often a thing that makes improv really painful to watch is people who are unwilling to just sit and be comfortable together, trusting that something's going to come up. And if nothing does, then being okay with that.
Yeah.
And I remember a scene at Bats that was... There were like six people on stage and something happened. And maybe it was a lounge singer. Like there was a lounge singer in a noir-y smoky cafe. And the entire stage went silent and let this singer sing for quite a while.
Mm.
And afterwards, I was reflecting on how rare that is in improv, for everyone to shut up and let a moment breathe, and how beautiful it is, and how there is watching people be comfortable in silence together and to give one another attention is It's just remarkable and rare, and it's very powerful.
It's a royal gift.
It's a real gift, and it's tricky in the same way that trust is tricky, because it takes everybody to agree that everybody to build it and only one person to destroy it.
Yes.
Or to change it, to change the nature of it.
I was mentioning the Inward Bound Mindfulness Education, or IBME, retreats earlier.
Yeah.
One of the things that we do and have done in those small groups is what we call hot seat, where one person is kind of getting interviewed and the other people can ask any question.
Yeah.
And it's like 20, usually 15 to 20 minutes.
Right.
And they're usually pretty intense. You know, you can ask, how hot do you want it? Do you want it super caliente?
Oh.
Or just like, you know, tepid?
Cool.
And usually the kids are like, no, turn it up. Go ahead.
Can you say...
And you can refuse a question, of course. Yep. Yep. Of course. And the facilitator's job is to keep checking in with the person, like, are you okay? Are you all right with this? But all of the listeners turn towards the person, and it's like, your job is to give this person your presence. And it's like eight people just like showering
attention
on this one person.
Quiet, focused attention, not
That's right.
like doting on attention.
Yeah.
Or...
And the questions are meant to be, you know, they're not like voyeuristic questions. It's, you know, what's a question that you think will allow this person to express his or herself?
Yeah.
And
or to explore something they maybe haven't thought about.
Yeah. And so it's like 15 to 20 minutes, and then they come off the hot seat, and we check in, well, so how was that, and how was that for the group? And over the course of a weekend retreat, you know, everybody in the group gets to go. It is so powerful.
So powerful.
Because you've just shared that depth of experience.
Yeah, and you combine attention, which is connective, with vulnerability.
Yep.
And being willing to be seen, which is connective.
Yeah. Boy, and talking about all this, having this experience this weekend, reminds me of how thirsty I am for this.
Yeah.
So I've moved out here, and I've become a part of the BATS community. I don't have a community of people around me where I live. I don't know my neighbors.
Very few people in this area do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, that's a malaise in the U.S., I'd say, in general.
Yeah.
Most places.
Reluctance or independence or something.
Yeah. But it's like trying to find that community. I adore my friends. Adore them. Most of them are really busy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have that kind of like regular group to check in.
People, yeah.
And, you know, we're lifting each other up, we're going out for food, or we're going to go for hang out in the park together. And, you know, as someone who likes to be alone and someone who's an introvert, like, I spend time at home by myself, that's really great. But I start to get thirsty, mm-hmm. you know, and then I have an experience like this week and I go, oh my God, this is so great.
Yeah. It's like a fire hose.
Walk into a room, like, I'll go talk to that person for 20 minutes. And then over here, like, oh, and this, here's a delicious little
pocket
trio. And,
yeah.
yeah. So I'm now re-inspired to like, all right, I got to find my peeps. I got to find a group to hang out with.
Yeah.
That we're all committed to forming that group.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That was great. It's a great question. I love that we started with this, your question of in what ways do improv and mindfulness build community?
Yeah. I was overwhelmed by how at home I felt this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It was profound.
Mm. Well, this
and I got the sense that everybody felt that way, or so many people felt that way. Mm-hmm. Like that this is a group that they are deeply grateful to be a part of.
Yeah.
They want to come back to it, and I've always thought that so much of that is not just that we shared this experience. We shared an experience in college, or we worked on something together, but that we worked on taking care of each other, and we worked on accepting each other, and we worked on being vulnerable together and changing and allowing ourselves to be changed by one another,
mm-hmm.
and saying yes to each other. And all of these things are social skills.
Mm-hmm.
They're all relationship building skills. So we were like double dutying the relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way. And we were like kissing each other in scenes and stuff. Like we were falling in love with one another and falling in, you know, like exploring the range of human emotion and human experience together
right.
in scenes and then talking about it afterwards. It's like approaching relationships from all angles.
Yeah.
it's so powerful. It's incredible.
I just now I'm thinking, you know, I have this thirst for this kind of community myself, more of this kind of community. And I'm recognizing, you know, there's a lot of people who never even get the taste of this.
They never get it.
And I so wish, I'm feeling right now, I so wish that everybody in the world gets to have just, you know, even just a glimpse.
Yeah.
But no, more than a glimpse, like an extended, ongoing experience of this kind of belonging.
Isn't belonging on Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
If it's not, it should be. Let's put it there.
It's on Roland's hierarchy. It's at the top of Roland's hierarchy of needs.
Okay.
She needs to belong somewhere. Anything. Food and shelter okay. and warmth. That factors in as well. A cat.
Some tea. Yeah.
Coffee.
Well, coffee in the morning, tea later. Yeah. Okay. Create your own community.
Depends on
okay,
the
okay, so much for community. You drink your coffee, I'm drinking tea. Forget it, we're too different.
Take your tea and go. No, right. I like tea.
Okay, tea's okay, great. And I'll put up with coffee.
Tea's great.
I think this is probably a good
place to wrap
good
up.
Place to pause. And I do want to say this already is like triggering all sorts of other things we could talk about. So
great.
I love
we'll come to them later.
Yeah, I love the way this is going. So you know, whoever's been listening, thank you so much for riding in on this conversation with us, and
yeah.
Hopefully it was helpful for you.
Yep, or interesting, or thought provoking, or something.
Yeah. So right on. May you have the community in your life that you hope for.
Oh yeah, and may you actively chase it and reinforce it where you find it.
Right on. To be continued.
Goodbye.
Ciao.
Listening, everybody, to our third episode of this podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got something out of it.
Really fun to have you with us, and we're eager to put together some more. We've got some other neat content up our sleeves, and we're about to head out for some adventures on the East Coast, where we're bringing this stuff to some more people. I want to let you know some interesting and exciting news. We have an easy way for you to get in touch with us now, because there is such a thing as monsterbabypodcast.com.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
So now, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email info@monsterbabypodcast.com, and we will get that email. It's very exciting. So go ahead and send us all your thoughts.
And if you want to send something, a question about me that you don't really want me to see because you're a little shy, you can send it to lisa@monsterbabypodcast.com.
Yeah, if you want to know if Ted's single or if he's, you know, on the market, etc., you can send those questions to me and I will discreetly respond.
She is a gatekeeper extraordinaire.
And if you're interested in any information, we're asking people to ask you anyway, to get us talking about each other. You can also email me at Lisa, or you can email Ted at monsterbabypodcast.com for any off limits to Lisa information you'd like.
Yeah, and we did that because it's just a lot easier than sending something to lisaroland.com and our having to combine it, or sending something to ted@animalearning.com, which is hard to spell out. So
like the word name for our radio, right? For having to speak out loud over the radio.
But monsterbabypodcast.com, if you go there, it's going to send you to a page that will have our podcast, and you can listen to episodes or subscribe. I want to really encourage you to subscribe, because that will help us, and it will make sure you get everything that we're putting out.
Yeah, and to remind you, we have a couple of retreats coming up if you'd like to come and play with us, our Mindful Play, Playful Mind retreats that explore a lot of this stuff up on its feet and interactively. We have one in June in Maine, which is June 8th to the 13th.
Correct.
And another one in Petaluma, just north of San Francisco, September, over Labor Day weekend. So hopefully, if you're interested or you know somebody who's interested, you can come join us. It would be a blast.
It's a total blast. And the one in Maine is going to be 5 days. It's right on the coast. Absolutely stunning. The one over
it's
Labor
gorgeous.
Day will just be 3 days. But both places, great food, great company, great stuff. I'd love to have you with us.
Yeah. So and we'll see you next time.
Right on. Thanks again for hanging out with us, and we'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Adios.